Welcome to Wise at Work, the podcast exploring the intersection of science, culture, and meaning in the workplace. I'm Corey Smith, CEO of Wisdom Labs, and your host. In this episode, Wisdom Labs' Michael Taft talks with Judson Brewer. Judson Brewer is an MD, PhD, and a thought leader in the field of habit change and the science of self-mastery. He has combined nearly 20 years of mindfulness training with his scientific research. A psychiatrist, an internationally known expert in mindfulness training for addictions, Brewer has developed novel mindfulness programs for habit change, including both in-person and app-based treatments. He is also the founder of Claritas Mind Sciences. And now, Judson Brewer, interviewed by Michael Taft.
Hey, Judd, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure. I want to jump right in on a topic that is of great interest in workplaces everywhere, and that is workplace burnout and maybe some resilience building ideas that you have.
That's a great question. Well, in medicine, nobody ever gets burnt out, so I have no idea what you're talking about. And actually, there's a term that's been developed. I don't know if it came out of the medical establishment. Doctors certainly like to come up with new terms. It's called empathy fatigue. And there have been a lot of studies in medicine, and I'm sure these are parallel with any workplace, but there's a huge amount of burnout in physicians, and they were trying to figure out what was going on. And it turns out that there's a high level of what's described as empathy fatigue. So if we unpack empathy a little bit, you know, in medical school, we're supposed to learn to be empathetic with our patients and literally as much figuratively as possible to put ourselves in our patient's shoes.
My doctor must have missed that class.
I skipped it. Well, I don't know how you really teach that, to be honest, but I think you're trying to teach it more and more. If you think of empathy as putting yourself in your patient's shoes and your patient is suffering, ergo, you're suffering. You know, I work in an outpatient clinic, so if I'm working 40 hours a week and putting myself in my patient's shoes, that's 40 hours of suffering a week. That's grounds for burnout. I mean, anybody would be burned out in that situation. So if the idea is to be empathetic with our patients and to put ourselves in their shoes and they're suffering, so therefore we're suffering, that's a recipe for disaster. And I think that's part of where a lot of physicians and clinicians have gotten burnt out over the years. So the question is, what can we do about that? As a neuroscientist, I always like to start with, well, can we understand what the problem is, even from a biological level?
Just to be clear, this isn't just a problem for physicians. There's a special intense version of it for physicians, but presumably this burnout could apply in any field.
Yes, I would say any field where people are working with each other. So if you're in customer relations, you want to be able to understand where your customer is coming from so you're going to be able to have a good relationship with them. Or if you're in sales, you're going to want to understand where your customer is coming from so you can have a good relationship with them. If you're a manager, you want to, understand where your employees are coming from so you can learn how to manage them. You know, it's essential, a human quality, to be able to relate to others. And how we relate to others is critical.
And so when we're relating to others, it sets us up for this possibility of empathy fatigue or burnout.
Yeah, absolutely. So if we're taking our coworkers suffering home with us at night and worrying about whether it's personal problems or things at work or just that our colleagues are stressed, then we're going to be stressed and we're going to get burnt out that way, especially if we feel like it's our job to help them. And often I think managers or folks that lead others take that on because they want to help, you know?
Yeah, it's just part of the human experience.
Part of the human experience, well said. So empathy fatigue is real. And I think this is where we can, I almost said the word compassion, but I think this is where we can start to look from, even from a biological standpoint, and say, well, what's going on with empathy and empathy fatigue? So we don't need to get into the science too much, but even from a very basic level, we can look to say, okay, well, if I'm putting myself in somebody's shoes and therefore I'm suffering, what does that I feel like when I am empathizing and suffering with this person to suffer with? You know, I think there's a very strong experiential component to that. So for example, let's start with something simple. If we get afraid, we can feel that. How do we feel that? How would you describe the physical experience of being afraid?
If it's strong fear, you would have, I'll just speak for myself, I have increase in heart rate, increase in breath rate, shallowness of breathing, sweaty palms, maybe some kind of upset stomach, and so on.
Great, thank you. And I would say, you know, from a survival standpoint, when we get afraid, if the proverbial saber-toothed tiger is coming after us, we make ourselves as small as possible so that it doesn't see us or it doesn't eat us, you know? And so you can even think of that on a very basic level. As our physiology gets jacked up like you're talking about, we contract down into this tiny little ball.
So you're trying to hide?
We're trying to hide. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it. So we're trying to hide when we're afraid. Well, we can look at that very simple aspect of experience, that contracted quality of experience, and see where that bleeds over. You know, so for example, when we're stressed out, that also tends to feel contracted, at least in my experience and what people describe to me. So that contracted quality, you know, if you think of trying to protect ourselves, trying to hide, that contraction is a physical manifestation of letting us know where we end and where the world begins. Right? So here I am. I feel the contraction. That's me. That's self. Okay? So if I am putting myself in somebody else's shoes and I'm contracting out of empathy, then I'm suffering because I'm there in that moment, you know, feeling that. So there's an I there that is suffering. Are there other ways to be with suffering that aren't self-related? Right? And so, you know, we've even found brain regions, and others have found this as well, where there's this self-referential brain network that's even correlated with this contracted feeling and all of that. But that's not even as important as the physical feeling of that contraction.
You would be referring to the default mode network?
I would be referring to the default network, yes, absolutely. And folks can read more about that if they're interested. But the contracted feeling comes out of a sense of I am suffering. So what can we learn from wisdom traditions? In Christianity, there's this term where we empty of the small self so that God can flow through us. In Buddhism more, in mindfulness more, it's about learning to identify the sense of self and where we get caught up in our sense of self and caught up in things. And in essence, we can get caught up in taking on someone else's suffering. Literally, we can get caught up in it, and we can feel that through contraction. And if we can understand that, if we can know how that works, we can also find directed solutions to that. So with mindfulness practice, we learn to notice what that feels like, and then we also learn how to let go.
How do you let go?
Easier said than done. It's not like something we can do, you know, and I certainly tried to do it my first 10 years of my own meditation practice. Trying to let go, the trying actually creates a larger sense of self in that contraction that's very similar to empathy fatigue. So the trying doesn't work, but the awareness does work pretty well. When we bring awareness to what that contraction feels like, we can feel that it's painful, it's uncomfortable, it causes more suffering, and then we naturally start to let go. It's kind of like holding onto a hot coal and thinking that it's going to keep us warm. You know, that's the empathy. Oh, I'm being empathetic. And then somebody says, hey, your hand's burning. We're like, no, dude, I'm being empathetic. And they're like, no, the room really smells like burning flesh. And we look at our hand and it's burning. We don't have to think, oh, hey, I should drop this coal. We naturally drop it. And I think that's what awareness practices help us do, are to see very clearly where we're causing our own suffering or contributing to our own suffering so that we naturally let go of that. And that comes through simply paying attention to our experience and seeing the cause and effect nature of this. Oh, if I hold on to this, if I take my coworker's pain home with me, then I get attached to it and I suffer.
So let's make the example of a manager who is caught up with their employee's home situation, and they then take that home themselves. They're thinking about it at night. They're having difficult emotions about it. How would they, in that example, actually work with this?
Well, the first thing that I would ask them is, well, what do you get from that? And they might say, well, I'm trying to figure out the solution to the problem. And I would say, how's that working for you? Not in a snotty way, but really just saying, you know, what do you get from that when you take that home? Well, I'm less present for my spouse and kids. I go to sleep with my shoulders all hunched over and contracted. I have trouble sleeping, all of that. And I say, well, wow, are you coming up with solutions? Well, not yet. I haven't quite figured it out yet. But there's this inclination for our minds to just think, if we just think harder, we're going to figure it out, which can actually lead into full-blown anxiety, which maybe we can touch on in a bit. But let's keep it here for a minute. So I would start there and just really say, well, let's pay attention to what we get from this.
So the idea is not, hey, quit doing that, and then just forcing yourself to stop doing it. It's instead to pay attention to what it feels like to do that.
As Jon Kabat-Zinn put it, it's more of a being than doing. So we are with our experience, we pay attention to our experience, but instead of that habitual reaction to do something about it, we simply rest in awareness and are curious, oh, what am I getting from this?
And when you say being with that experience, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about simply bringing a kind, curious awareness to it.
To what?
To the actual physical sensations, to the emotions, to the thoughts. So noticing, oh, there's a self-judgmental thought, or, oh, there's fear. Oh, this is what fear feels like right now in my body. It's clenching, it's restless, it's burning, that type of thing.
Okay, that sounds awful.
It is awful. And this is where the kind curiosity comes in. I think that's a really critical piece. So we can either notice this awfulness that's happening in our body and then add to it where we think, oh, there's awful and this is awful. And then we start spinning out of control with the awful of the awful. Or we can step back and get curious about it. So what does curiosity feel like? Does it feel awful?
Curiosity is a great thing to experience.
Yeah. So it's not like we're going to magically pop out of awfulness and never feel awful again. But in that moment where we start to go over that event horizon into that black hole of awfulness with anxiety feeding on itself, we can step back and inject a bit of curiosity and say, oh, what does awful feel like? And then in that moment, we can notice that there's a little bit less of a contraction. And in that moment, there's a great possibility to know that, one, this awfulness isn't going to last forever, that, two, I don't have to get sucked into this black hole because there's an alternative that's always available. Curiosity, it's always available.
I've sometimes heard that curiosity is the opposite of anxiety.
On a very basic level, I would agree with that. So if we think of anxiety as something that makes us contracted, and it's certainly my experience, and we think of curiosity, does it feel contracted or expanded?
Definitely expanded.
So in that sense, it's truly the opposite.
That makes sense.
Yeah, plain and simple. It really doesn't take more than noticing that one is contracted and one is expanded to even start to tap into that and say, oh, I don't have to feed on this contraction and make it more contracted. There's another way to be.
So for this theoretical manager going home with their employees' difficulties, the idea is to simply get curious about what that feels like.
That's one place to start, so that they're not sucked into the awfulness of it. Absolutely. So that they can get curious, they can notice that these are sensations and not have it feed itself. And this gives them the ability to be with that suffering in a way that is not walling themselves off, but also not getting sucked into it. And I say that because one of the natural reactions is to say, oh, this is awful. I'm just going to steel myself to this. I'm going to put up a wall. And that's what we see in physicians in particular, is that they become indifferent. And so people go to their physician and they say, boy, she or he was very cold to me. And that may just be a physician that's burnt out and they just can't handle taking on any more awfulness.
So they've learned to just shut down the empathy.
Yes, they shut it down. It's in a self-protective, reactive mode that they're doing that. Not anything malicious. It's just how our minds work. So that's not helpful for anybody. The clinician's shut down. The patient feels like their clinician is not empathetic. Nobody wins in that situation. So what can we do? Well, here's where we can say, okay, well, are there other ways of being? If we can notice what shutdown feels like, if we can notice our habitual reaction when we empathize, what if we take self out of the equation? Not in an indifferent or shut down or walled off way, but in a way that even paradoxically helps us connect more with our coworkers or our patients.
How do you take self out of the way?
I think it comes back to contraction versus expansion, honestly. I think we can keep this very simple, and it's not dumbing it down. I think there's really a beauty to the simplicity. If we notice that contraction is this marker of self, whether it's fear, whether it's anxiety, whether it's getting caught up in thinking about ourselves or worrying about ourselves, we can see how painful that is. Just like we can see how painful anything is, getting caught up in a narrative, worrying about the future. And then we can inject a bit of curiosity and start to move from contraction or a continuing of contraction into expansion, you know, with that curiosity. And then we can open ourselves to joy. We can open ourselves to further connection. And when we open to those, what does connection feel like? Does it feel contracted or expanded?
Expanded.
Yeah. So we can start to tap into these natural modes of being that literally draw us out of ourselves. And in that way, we can start to tap into this selfless way of being that doesn't require us to have some internal narrative always, you know, saying, oh, this should happen, you should do this. The shoulds are toxic, you know. You should do this, you shouldn't do that, you should be nice, you should be more empathetic. So that's like that little narrator of self that comes in and just mucks everything up. If we can step back, get out of this self-referential or self-focused way of being, we start to expand and we realize that we can actually be with our coworkers, we can be with our patients in a way that we're not self-protected, we're more connected, and in essence, we're actually more alive. And it feels better, right? We just tap into what we think of in science as reward-based learning. Oh, it feels better to be connected than disconnected. Oh, it feels better to get out of my own way than to trip myself up.
Now, does this take some kind of lifelong meditation practice to get to this place?
Yes, this is impossible. That's why we're talking about it. Sounds great, doesn't it? Yeah. I'm a clinician, and I want to do things that are going to help people pragmatically in the 20-minute visit that I have with them. So anybody can tap into what it feels like to be contracted when they're afraid, and anybody can tap into what it feels like to be expanded when they're being generous or when they're joyful or when they're getting out of their own way. In this way, anybody can tap into this. It's a matter of kind of calibrating our system so we know what contracted versus expanded feels like. And when we can tap into that, we can start to notice, oh, these are the times when I get in my own way. And we can just ask ourselves, what do I get from that? Right? Just like the person that's taking somebody else's suffering home with them, they're suffering. And then we start to drop those hot coals over and over and over, and we start to learn to live more in this mode that's not as self-focused. And that's where, you know, I think of, in contrast to empathy, there's compassion. So compassio literally means to suffer with. So it's that essential quality of empathy that we're trying to learn in medical school. That's not lost. To suffer with, we're still suffering with our patients or our coworkers or whatever. But if we are not worrying about protecting ourselves, something else naturally arises that's beautiful. This connection, this willingness to be with and to help. Why? Because that's what our job is. Whether we're a clinician or a salesperson or a manager, our job is to be here helping. Right? Working with a team. And if we don't have to devote that energy to protecting ourselves, we become more resilient because stuff that comes our way, we don't have to worry about getting out of the way or dodging it or worrying that we're going to be damaged by it. It just happens. And then we naturally meet it, whether it's somebody else's suffering or some task that we were tasked with that seems impossible. We're like, okay, here it is. As compared to, oh, that's terrible. That's awful. What's going to happen to me? This is where compassion has the space to arise naturally out of the conditions of getting out of our own way.
Now, aren't you releasing an app soon that helps with anxiety?
Yes, we are releasing one very shortly. It's called Unwinding Anxiety, and it was built on not only the science that we've been doing for the last decade or more, but also my clinical practice and also my personal mindfulness practice. And in essence, it's very much what we've been talking about. We help people identify the habit loops and how their minds work, where they get sucked into that black hole of anxiety, and then help them be curious about that so that they see that there is an alternative, and then give them some very simple mindfulness practices that they can do throughout their day. And it's really important with people with anxiety. If we give them one more thing to do, guess what? It makes them more anxious. So we really try to embed these and integrate these into their daily lives so that they can learn to use these practices throughout the day. There's this great term, short moments many times. They can have short moments where they wake up to contraction, short moments where they wake up to perpetuating some anxiety habit loop, and then can learn that they don't have to feed that. They can step out of it. They can bring curiosity to it. They can bring self-kindness to themselves if they're beating themselves up. And they can learn to unwind. That's why it's called unwinding anxiety. And so we can bring short videos, animations, in the moment exercises all together where somebody can learn this. They take 5 minutes in the morning, learn a lesson for the day, and then go throughout their day and practice it. And we can make this a progressive training where they can go, you know, we have modules and modules, like 30 or more different modules that people can learn all these different nuances that build on the previous modules as well.
And so this work that you're doing with anxiety uses, it sounds like, precisely the same principles as overcoming empathy fatigue.
Absolutely. I mean, all of this is based on that underlying science that my lab has been studying for years, which is, oh, what's that like? What's the self-reference like? How can we operationalize that? How can we bring that to bear where people can see that very clearly and then be able to work with it? And all of that is built on, can we understand how our minds work? And we do have a pretty good understanding, at least on how basic habits are formed, and anxiety is no different. It's no exception to that rule.
Okay, so you've got what I would summarize as ways to reduce the negative. So if you have empathy fatigue or lack of resilience or an anxiety problem, these techniques will reduce those difficulties. But what about if someone wants to accentuate the positive or use these same techniques to make their life even more full? Do they work in that direction also?
Absolutely. I think this is all along one continuum where you can think of fully contracted into a neutron star, a black hole on one side, and then all the way expanded where we can't find the boundary between ourselves and the world on another. You know, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi, a well-known psychologist, described this as flow. And so any moment we can be moving toward contraction or away from it toward expansion.
And so how would you do that?
Very much in the same way. So we find the conditions that lead to contraction. We pay attention to those. We see how rewarding they actually are so we can tap into our natural reward-based learning systems and say, oh, that's not actually that rewarding. We recalibrate our brains so that they say, oh, you really want to do that again? And we let go of those old habits, which frees up all the energy to start saying, well, what's better than this? And we start exploring, oh, what's it feel like to be kind? What's it feel like to really pay attention when the person that I'm supervising is asking me a question or reporting back? Am I thinking about my next task? Am I surreptitiously checking my tweets on my phone? Or am I really looking them in the eye and taking in what they're saying, having that fully connected conversation? In that moment, I'm moving toward flow. Right? In that moment. So we can go through our entire workday and just check in. Am I contracted right now or am I expanded? Oh, what led to these conditions? Not that one is better than the other, because I see this as we can learn from both. And our minds naturally incline toward those things that are less painful, those things that are more joyful. And I would have to say, I don't know anything that beats out flow in terms of joyful.
Normally, when we hear the psychologist Csikszentmihalyi talking about flow, he seems to be talking about pro athletes or concert musicians or something. How does this apply to a typical workplace?
Well, I think he describes those extreme situations just as examples. So often in extreme sports or in music, these are conditions that support flow. So I think of looking at the conditions that support flow for anybody. You don't have to be an extreme athlete. You don't have to be a musician. Now, extreme athletes describe flow and the conditions in terms of the extremity. So, for example, if it takes energy to worry about what's going to happen next, then that energy can't be used for a behavior or for a maneuver on a ski slope, for example. And if the maneuver is so extreme that we don't have any extra energy to worry, then our brain gives itself a choice. It's like, you can either do this or you can die. And typically, it'll err on the side of, okay, let's do this and we'll worry about how bad it was later. So there's a way to kind of shut off the self to force that function in essence, to shut off that worry, that self-reference. So that's not something that we can do. I can't even think of a workplace example of that, but I think that's why he describes extreme sports in that way, where there's a forcing function for shutting down the self. That's kind of forced. I think in the workplace, we can find those conditions that move us in the direction. We don't necessarily need to be in full-on flow every day at work, but we can find the conditions that continually move us in that direction. So for example, curiosity is one of the great ones. We can foster our natural capacity to be curious. And in those moments, we can notice the joy that comes from not knowing, from letting go, from having this beginner's mindset, because we're curious, oh, what is the answer? As compared to coming into the meeting saying, I know the answer, and then having to defend ourselves. That's exhausting compared to saying, huh, what is going on? You know, I have a lot of people in our programs who say, well, what if I'm not feeling curious? And we can say, well, you can be curious about why you're not curious. Boom. We're at least moving in that direction in that moment.
So what would you say is the takeaway for people who want to both reduce some of these negative experiences and increase some of these more positive flow type experiences?
I would say the one takeaway is a curious awareness. So being curious, oh, what's it feel like when I'm contracted down in a state of fear or anxiety? That's key. And then also noticing, oh, what's it feel like when I'm curious, when I'm getting out of my own way? That helps our brain learn, oh, this is painful, this is not painful.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Judd.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Corey, co-founder and CEO of Wisdom Labs. At Wisdom Labs, we're helping companies become wiser workplaces. To create this positive impact in organizations, we cultivate change at the level of the individual, team, and company culture. We see businesses as the biggest lever for positive social change at scale. After all, business still holds the most power and influence in our world. And as individuals, company cultures, and entire stakeholder networks become more wise, we all benefit. To learn more about Wisdom Labs, check out wisdomlabs.com. Thanks for listening.